Okay, so let's get started here. Several announcements. So first one is office hours. So if you remember, my as I had announced in the first class that my office hours are going to be immediately after class on both Tuesdays and Thursdays. Office hours, yes. So I'm going to make one change to that. On Tuesdays, which is also today, I will have my office hour before class, and on Thursdays I will have it after class. Okay, this is just to allow those of you who have classes at 2 to actually come to office hours. Otherwise you will be blocked on both Tuesdays and Thursdays. So I'm going to stagger them. Okay, I'll make the change on the web page, but just keep in mind that on Tuesdays you can come before class 12 to 1 and on Thursdays you can come after. Okay, and then Sashi is still going to have his office hours on Mondays and Fridays. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing is with respect to the project, we are going to hand it out soon. The first one will be a warm-up exercise, really, just to get you familiar with programming in C++. As I had mentioned, you can do these projects in groups of 2 or 3. I recommend groups of 2 or 3 because sometimes the coordination gets more complicated. Okay? But it's important for you to declare your group soon. Okay? So I would like you to talk to others in the class and form groups of either 2 or 3 and send me email. Okay, the reason I need to know this is, as I had mentioned, we use this automatic program to grade you, and we need to tell the program what the groups are. Okay, so it knows who is working with who else, and it can sort of assign grades accordingly. Okay, so no later than end of this week. So it would be good if you can let me know by Thursday, but the real hard deadline is Friday. Okay, to form a group, I will, so you can talk among yourselves. I will put a pointer to an online bulletin board if you want to solicit group members. If you want me to assign a random group, I will wait until everyone is paired up and then you will get assigned a random group member. But that's the least ideal circumstance because you don't know who you will be working with. Okay, so please go ahead and try to form groups based on discussions among yourselves. Okay, that's the second thing. And then there will be a discussion section tomorrow. Okay, we didn't have a discussion section last week, but we are going to start from tomorrow, and from now on you'll have a discussion every Wednesday. So that's going to be again in this room at noon. Okay, it's noon, right? Or 11:20. Okay, so 12:20, about an hour. So we will supplement the material we cover in the lecture. So you should definitely go to the discussion section. It's not optional. Okay, so make sure you go there and benefit from what we will cover. Okay, any other questions on any of these announcements? Is this clear? Okay, so make sure you send us group information. You can just email that to me. Okay, once you form a group, just tell me who you are pairing with and make sure you include your EdLab account name. Okay, that is how we will identify group members, by your EdLab account ID. Okay, so just send me that. And I'll put a note about this on the course webpage so you know what to send. Okay, so let's continue where we left off last time. So we were doing this C++ tutorial. Okay, so we have covered a whole bunch of things, and the things to keep in mind are the main big difference between C++ and Java is this notion of pointers. Pointers are memory addresses, and you can do lots of interesting things with pointers, but they are also the single thing that are most likely to trip you up. Okay, so be careful as to how you use pointers in your program. That's the thing to keep in mind. Okay. Lots of similarities, but there are these important differences also. Okay, so see some other features in C++. One is operator overloading. Okay, just as you have standard operators like plus and minus and times and so on, you can actually overload these operators, meaning that for within a class you can use that operator and define what that means when you take two objects of that class and use that operator. So here is basically the plus operator. So you are defining a plus operator on a new data type. Okay. What plus means for integers and floats is predefined. Okay, but you can define plus for other types, data types. And in this case, you can have a complex number as your data type, just as an example. And you can define plus, and that's a function. Okay, you can then get those two arguments and do something in return. Okay, so that's so it is very useful to use that. So it's basically a shorthand in some sense because you're doing operator overloading, but you can use them for complex math or matrix operations. You can take two matrices or two vectors and just define the plus operator. Okay, and then you have to write the function as to what that means for that data type. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind. The other useful thing to keep in mind, and this is something you will actually make use of immediately in your first assignment, is this notion of templates or the standard template library. Okay? This is a library of data structures that is already defined for you in C++. So you have usual suspects like linked lists and hash functions and whatnot. And then you can use these templates in your program to do useful things. And this is how you would use a template, and then you have a class name, and then you will have functions. And here is an example on how to use STL. So in this case, we are using the queue data structure in this program. Okay, so you are using queues to do something. And rather than writing your own queue, okay, you use the queue data structure that's already defined for you in the standard template library. So the way you would go about doing this, first you have to declare what type of a queue you want to use. So in this case, you use a queue of integers. So you have this parenthesis and you have a data type there that tells the program or the compiler what type of a queue you are using. Okay, in this case, it's a queue of integers. So once you declare it in that way, then you can use all the standard functions that are defined by that library. In this case, you can push objects onto the queue, you can pop objects from the queue. All of the standard operations on the queue are already predefined for you. So there are many such data structures, okay, that the STL uses. And this is one thing that you should be familiar with because it saves you a lot of work. Okay, if you had to write your own queue class, then you would have to go and figure out how to implement the push and the pop and what your internal representation of the queue is going to be. Here you don't worry about all of that. You just say it's a queue of integers and you just use push and pop, and the STL has an internal representation for a queue which you don't really need to be aware of, and it does all of the heavy lifting for you. Okay, so this is something to keep in mind. Okay, and this is what you will use, as I said, starting from the first programming assignment. Not the queue, but the standard template library. Okay, yes, question there.
Is there like a database online or something that just templates anything?
Okay, that's a good question. So, question is what kinds of data structures are available in the standard template library. So, I will make several references available. Okay, and they will tell you about STL and all of the common things that are available. Okay, there are online references, there are books. I will try to put a couple of these books on reserve in the library and so on. Okay, but as far as the programming assignments are concerned, we will provide plenty of hints so you'll know what to use, okay, and how to look it up and so on. But if you just need to do your own exploration, we'll have additional references. Okay. Are there any other questions here? Okay, so that was a very quick refresher, or not a refresher, rather a tutorial on C++. Okay, now there is a lot more to learn, but this should get you started. And we will provide more details as we go by. Okay, what I'm going to do now is actually do a refresher on architecture. Okay, this is stuff that you should know something about in order for you to understand basic concepts in operating systems. Okay. So what we have done so far is we did a very quick intro to what operating systems are and a history of operating systems, and I did the C++ tutorial. So this is the picture that I had put up in the first class. Okay, so you have basically the hardware, and the operating system is a software layer that sits on the hardware. Okay, it uses the physical machine interface, and it provides a nicer logical interface to the end user. Okay, this interface makes it easier for users and applications to make use of the underlying hardware. Okay, that's basically what an operating system does. Okay, so we looked at a quick history of operating systems, and we looked at how changes in hardware motivate evolution of operating systems and vice versa, how OS needs have actually motivated some hardware functionality. So what we are going to do today is quick recap of some basic OS functionality. I'll do a quick overview of what hardware looks like, okay, what computer hardware looks like. Okay, and then we'll take it from there and start building on that, okay, in the next several classes. Okay, so basically any modern operating system provides us these features. Okay, I'm not sure why it is numbered 13579. Some PowerPoint problem. Okay, so concurrency, I/O, memory management, storage, okay, and networking and distributed system support. So this is what you should expect from any modern operating system. So let's look at what each of these needs. Okay, what each functionality. So what is concurrency? Concurrency is the ability to do multiple things or several things simultaneously. Okay, in parallel in some sense. Okay, so how does it work? In your typical desktop or your laptops, you may have several applications all running at the same time. You may have a browser open, you may have mail open, or you may have something else running in the background. So that effectively is what concurrency does for you. The operating system allows you to run multiple things all at once. Okay, multiple users may be accessing the machines and also running their own program. Okay, so all of this falls under this notion of concurrency. Several users working at the same time, multiple applications running at the same time, multiple threads, and we'll look at the notion of threads in a few classes. Multiple threads of an application executing at the same time and so on. Okay. Now this is a topic that has become more important in the recent past, in the recent few years. And the reason for this is if you buy any modern desktop or a laptop, you get what are called multiple cores. You get a dual core or a quad core machine. What that means is basically your machine has multiple CPUs, okay, multiple processors. Okay, if you have multiple processors, then you can run multiple applications in parallel. Okay, so how do you write applications in order to exploit concurrency has become a very important problem in the recent years. Okay, so we will look at some issues related to multi-core architecture somewhere later in this course. Okay, not in the next few classes, but keep this in mind. Okay, now you can have this notion of concurrency even if you have only one processor on your machine. Okay, even if you have only one processor, the OS still allows you to run multiple applications, but it switches between them. Okay, in a round robin fashion or some such thing. Okay, so you'll run application A for some time and the OS will switch to application B and still give you the illusion of concurrency. Okay, things are not really running in parallel all at once, but they are switching, they are sort of cycling between, the OS is cycling between apps, but you still get the illusion of concurrency. If you have multiple cores, then applications can really execute in parallel. Application A could be running on the first core and application B could be running on the second core both at the same time. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay, I/O devices. So you know about I/O devices. So there's anything that is related to input output. So what I/O functionality allows us to do is the CPU could be executing a program while the I/O device is either servicing an input or an output request. So think of a printer. Okay, so you send off a print job and then the OS will invoke the print driver which will start printing to the printer. Okay, and while this is happening, some other application could be running on the machine. Okay, so this allows you to overlap both computation and I/O. Okay, and this is another important functionality that the operating system provides us. Okay, memory management. Yeah, this is yet another important topic. So what happens in this context is that you have some amount of main memory on your machine and your multiple applications that are all loaded in memory or are running together. Okay? The operating system has to then partition this memory and allocate different chunks of memory to different applications. Okay? And this the topic of memory management tells us how an operating system goes about taking what is available in main memory and partitioning it or allocating it to different applications. Okay? And also the problem of how do you move data from disk to memory and vice versa. When you start off a program, it's actually on disk. How does it get loaded into memory? How does it start running? All that is also part of this topic. Okay? And then files. So every machine comes with a disk. What's on a disk is called a file system. Okay? So what is a file? File is basically a container of data. Okay? This is basically the unit in which you store data of any kind. Okay, it could be your Word documents, it could be email, it could be your music files. So what are file systems and how does the operating system manage disk space and provide this illusion of files is basically part of this topic. Okay, and then the last thing is the distributed systems and networks. So this is where the operating system allows other machines to communicate with it and it also communicates with some other machine. So if you look at web applications or mail or any of these applications that require networking support, then basically all of that comes under this topic. Okay. Now these are also the topics we are going to cover in this course. Okay. So I'm not expecting that you know now what all of these mean. You may just know the name of the topic, but each of this will be several one or more chapters in the book, and we'll spend several lectures on them. So not in necessarily this order. We'll actually start with concurrency, processes and threads. Then we'll go to memory management. That will be the second major topic. I/O devices and files will be the third topic. And distributed systems and networking will be the fourth major component of the course. So if you think of four pieces of the course, these would be processes and threads and concurrency, memory management, I/O devices, files would be one topic, and distributed systems. So to summarize, okay, so we have looked at what role an operating system plays, and we have looked at it in different ways. Okay, there are different facets to this. So you think of OS as a juggler, where basically there's a dedicated machine, and it is providing this illusion of unlimited memory and CPU. Okay, and it's trying to arbitrate these resources across multiple applications. So if you think of the operating system as government, it basically its task is to protect users from one another, so that a user doesn't inadvertently or maliciously do damage to some other user's applications and or data. Okay? It allocates resources efficiently and more importantly fairly across applications. It provides safe and secure communication. Okay? So that's basically what an operating system does as a resource manager. So you can also think of an operating system as a complex software system. Okay? If you take any operating system kernel, right? If you take let's say Windows Vista, okay, up to 100 million lines of code, okay, go into what forms the operating system. Okay, that's a very large software system. It's a very complex software system. It takes more than a day just to build a Vista kernel. Linux is also several hundred thousand lines of code. If you add all the drivers, then it goes into millions of lines of code. Okay, building the Linux kernel also can take minutes or hours depending on what components you are actually building. Okay? So design of such complex software systems is also an interesting software engineering problem. And one thing that we learn in this course is how to go about building this very large software system. Okay, an operating system is just one example. There are other complex systems like databases and stuff that also use some similar principles. Yeah, modularity and so on. Okay? And we also look at operating systems as a history teacher, as we learn from the past and try to see how these systems have evolved over time. Okay? How can we position them to address needs that may arise in the future and so on. Okay, and this is where you actually make design trade-offs with technology. okay, what does the technology give you and how do you go about making design decisions in the operating systems. Yeah. So these are things that we will learn as we go along. Okay. Any questions here? Is this clear? Okay. So let's start with this refresher. Okay. So we'll talk about what a computer hardware looks like. So this is a picture of what a typical PC should look like. Okay. So there are several key components. There's the central processing unit, the CPU. Okay. There's the system bus. There are I/O devices, and there is main memory. Okay. So the system bus is the interconnect. It's the thing that actually connects all of these other things together. Okay. It allows any of these devices to communicate with any other device as the need may be. Okay. So here is the CPU. So you all should know what a CPU is and what it does. This is the processor. This is where you actually execute instructions. Okay, that basically either a program or the operating system itself issues. Okay. So this is main memory. Okay. So this is where is your program or data that are currently executing reside. Okay. So typically what happens is the CPU fetches code from main memory and it executes them one at a time. Okay. This is basically how any machine works. Okay. And all of the other things are actually the various types of I/O devices. You have a disk controller that's connected to disks. Okay. These are hard drives. So this is what allows you to access any of the data that's stored on disks. You may have a USB bus, which is basically has a USB controller, and there may be multiple devices attached to it. Okay, this is also an I/O device, so there's a mouse and your keyboard and a printer. And there may be different types of controllers. That's a USB controller, but you may have FireWire or other types of controllers. Okay, your graphics adapter, so yet another I/O device, okay, and typically it is connected to a monitor. Okay, so this is how you can actually see what's happening on your console. Okay, so that's basically an output device. There's no input on a graphics card. It's a purely an output device. Okay. And you may have a network card or a wireless card or wireless network card. This allows you to communicate with other machines on the network. Okay, that's also an I/O device. Okay, it allows you to send packets, which is an output, or it allows you to receive packets, which is input. Okay. And they're all connected by this thing, this interconnect called a system bus. Yeah, this is a picture to keep in mind. Any questions here? Okay. So now let's talk about different OS services and what hardware support. What is it that you have seen in the previous picture that allow you to implement this functionality? Okay. First one is protection. Okay, I said operating system protects users from one another. It protects data that belongs to one user from other users and so on. So what is the hardware feature? What is it that you actually have in the previous slide in these components that allow you to allow the operating system to implement protection? Okay. First one is kernel user mode. Okay. Then there are protected instructions and base and limit registers. Okay, so these are typical hardware features that allow or that the operating system uses to implement protection. Okay. Now, do you all know about these? This is something you should be somewhat familiar with. Or is this the first time you are hearing about them? Have people heard of kernel user mode on a processor? Yes. Protected instructions or privileged instructions? Protection rings, terms sound familiar. Base limit registers, yes. I'll talk about these a little bit, okay. So it's not that I'm just going to ask and move on. We'll come back to this, okay. So yeah, yet another OS service is interrupts, okay. And these are implemented at the hardware level, or the hardware feature that you use to implement interrupts in the operating system are interrupt vectors or trap vectors. Again, something you should be familiar with, but I'm going to review in any case. Okay. System calls is yet another operating system feature. This is what you typically use. This is what applications typically use to communicate with the operating system. Okay. The other feature that you will again use to implement them would be trap instructions. Okay. This is a form of privilege instructions and trap vectors. Okay. IO, what you will use is memory maps and interrupts. And then you will, to implement either scheduling, error recovery, or accounting, you have the notion of timers. Okay, this is a hardware feature. Okay, to implement synchronizations, you have special instructions called atomic instructions. And to implement virtual memory, we have TLBs or translation lucaside buffers. Okay, again, this is what we are going to cover in this course. These are the features that you should be somewhat familiar with. Okay, and I'm going to do a quick review of these features. Okay, otherwise, if you don't know that, you will not know how we implement these, okay, as we go along. Okay, so let's start with protection. Okay, what's kernel mode and what's user mode? Okay, so to protect the system from malicious program or malicious users, typical processors have different modes of operation. Okay, typically an application executes in what's called a user mode. Okay, and there is a special mode called the kernel mode where you can do some additional stuff that applications in the user mode cannot do. Okay, so in effect what you have in the kernel mode are some special instructions that you can never execute from the user mode. Okay, so these instructions you can never execute. If you try to execute these instructions and you are in the user mode, then the hardware is going to give you an error. Okay, and these special instructions allow you to do things that only the kernel should do, which is why it's called a kernel mode. Okay, so what are these what are things that the user shouldn't or application shouldn't directly do? They shouldn't address I/O directly. Okay, an application should not have direct access to the disk at the block level. Okay, why should I not give an application access to the disk?
Because if it has access to the raw block level, it can do things like corrupt the file system, do things like falsify file records, and right, all sorts of nasty stuff.
Yes, so if the application has direct access to the disk, then I can read your data. Because then I can just read any arbitrary block, and that block may actually belong to a file that does not belong to me, that belongs to some other user, and the user has not granted write access to anyone. Okay? So typically all I/O access has to go through the operating system, and the operating system will first perform checks to see if you are authorized to access the data you requested. Okay? So users will never directly do I/O. The OS will do I/O on behalf of users after doing the write checks for you. Okay? So this is a privileged operation, something that only the kernel can do, and can only happen in the kernel mode. Okay, instruction that manipulates state of memory is again something an application cannot do. Application cannot muck around with memory state. Can allocate, deallocate memory, but it cannot change some things like the page table pointers, TLBs, and so on. Okay? Same reason to implement protection. If I actually give applications direct access to memory, then I can read what is happening in another process or another program. This program may be executed, or this program may have been started off by some other user. Okay, this again breaks the protection boundary. So this is a privileged operation. Okay, set mode bits that determine whether you are executing in the user or kernel mode. Okay, so the processor has bits which say, is it in the user mode or kernel mode? Clearly a user application shouldn't be able to modify this bits. Okay, otherwise it will get kernel mode access, and it will be able to do arbitrary malicious things. Okay, enable and disable interrupts. Okay, again privileged mode operation, and halting the machine. Okay, you don't want the application to issue the halt instruction and just stop the machine. Again, only the operating system can do this. Okay, so you can now, OS always runs in the kernel mode. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Applications run in the user mode, the OS runs in the kernel mode. And in the kernel mode, you can do any of this. Okay, the operating system is always assumed to be trusted. Okay, it's assumed that the OS knows what it is doing. So you give it full access. Okay, the OS can access any disk block, it can enable, disable interrupts at will, it can manipulate memory, because we trust the OS, and the OS is assumed to know what it is doing. Okay, but user applications are never trusted, okay, because applications may have bugs and it could do arbitrarily bad things, so we never trust the users or the application. Okay, so now to implement this basic notion of protection, okay, you need hardware support. And the hardware support that you have is basically at least one kernel mode and a user mode. Okay? You can have multiple modes, but you at least need two modes, a kernel mode and a user mode. Okay, if you look at the x86 architecture, it has the notion of protection rings. Okay, there's something called ring 0, ring 1, ring 2, and ring 3. Okay, ring 0 is the kernel mode on an x86 architecture. Ring 3 is the user mode. Okay, there's ring 1 and ring 2 where you get weaker and weaker privileges. Okay, ring 0 has full privileges, ring 3 has the least privileges. Okay, you can have ring 1 and 2. So things can actually run in ring 1 and 2. Okay, which are more privileged than user programs, but less privileged than the kernel. And then typically these other things are not used, but in special circumstances like virtual machines, they are actually put to good use. Okay, and we'll come back to that, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, but there's a status bit that tells you what mode the processor is in. If the bit is, let's say, 1, and that indicates you're in the kernel mode, then you can execute any instructions that do any of this. But if that bit is not set, okay, then it indicates the processor is in user mode. So if any application tries to do any of this, it basically gets segmentation fault. Okay, is this clear? What protection does? Okay. Now, how do you cross protection boundaries? Okay. This is what is done using the notion of a system call. Okay, so I said users, for just to give you an example, okay, I said users cannot address I/O devices directly. Yet applications need the functionality of being able to read and write files. Okay, you cannot directly access the disk at a low level, but you still need to be able to read and write data. How would you go about doing this? Okay, this is done using this notion of a system call. Okay, system, think of a system call as basically an OS procedure that executes privilege instruction that can do any of the things that we talked about here, okay, on behalf of applications. So how does it work? So here is a picture that basically shows you how a system call actually works. Okay, so here is a user process. Okay, it's when this process is executing, the CPU is in user mode. Okay, no privileges, no special privileges. So suppose that the user wants to do some I/O. Let's say it wants to open a file and read it. Okay, but the user cannot directly do this. Okay, the way it works is that the application has to issue a system call. Okay, so it actually executes a system call. And what that does is it actually causes a trap. Okay, when you execute a system call, what the OS does is it temporarily pauses execution of this application and switches to kernel mode. Okay, so this call sends all of the parameter to the operating system kernel. The kernel is then going to do the I/O on behalf of the application after doing appropriate checks. In case of file I/O, you have to check that this process actually can read or write or execute whatever it wants to do, the file that it wants to access. Okay, so it'll do this checks, execute the system call, and then it returns. Okay, so it basically looks like a function call, except that this is a special function call that is executed by the kernel on behalf of the application. And to do this, you have to first do a trap that basically stops or suspends execution of this application. The kernel executes a system call. You come back and the application resumes execution. Okay? Is this clear? Okay, there are several things to sort of keep in mind. There are lots of details I didn't mention. Okay, now when you actually do this trap, what is happening underneath the covers? Okay, because you are suspending execution of this program, okay, you have to basically save the caller state. Okay, you have to save its program counter, you have to save its register and all of this somewhere, okay, in kernel memory, and then you can execute the system call. Okay, now why do you have to save the caller state? Yes. Okay, so you can restore it. Because you are making the system call, this is effectively a function call. Okay, at some point, this function is going to return to you, okay, saying I am done. And at that point, you have to continue or resume execution of this application. Okay, but in the meanwhile, the kernel has taken over and is executing something on your behalf. Okay, so to know where to resume execution, you have to save the caller state. Okay, so that you can restore it when you are done executing the system call. Okay, is this clear? Okay. All right. So we'll come back to how this trap works in just a moment. Okay, I just put this thing called a trap, but I didn't actually tell you what this does. Okay. and how this system, how that code, piece of code starts executing. Okay, but before that, let's talk about memory protection. Okay. So I already mentioned what memory protection is. So the architecture or the hardware must provide some support to protect user programs from one another, and also to protect the OS from other programs. Okay, you don't want an application to start attacking the OS. The OS must be protected from all other applications, and each application that's currently running in memory must be protected from one another. Okay? Now how do you do this? How do you go about doing this? So what does it mean to protect one application from another? Okay, let's assume this is main memory. Okay, this is the kernel. Okay, and then there are these four jobs or four applications or four programs that are currently loaded in memory and are executing. Okay, what does it mean to protect one application from another in this context? Yes. Yes, so you don't want them to overwrite. So you don't want this process or this application to overwrite some other application's memory. Okay. You also don't want this process to read some other application's memory. Okay. So what you want is basically any memory accesses that are issued by this program, okay, should only access this region of memory and nothing else. Okay, because this is the only valid region of memory as far as this process is concerned. If you allow access to any of the other regions of memory, you are giving access to someone else's code or data. Okay? So how do you provide this notion of memory protection? And this is done using what are called base and limit. There are many techniques, but the most simple one is what are called base and limit registers. Okay? Base and limit registers are simply what they store is where the program begins in memory and where it ends. Okay, assume for now that the process is contiguously stored in memory. This is not the case in reality, but for simplicity, let's assume the entire process is loaded in one contiguous chunk. So your base register says where does the process begin in main memory, the limit register says where it ends. Okay? So every time this process issues any memory access whatsoever, you will basically check if that memory address falls in this range. Okay. If it falls in this range, then you allow it. If it goes outside this range, then you disallow it. Okay, this is just doing range checks. Okay, saying I'm allowed only to access this region of memory. So whenever I issue any memory access, I see what is the memory address you are trying to access. Is it in this range? Okay, if so, you allow. If not, you don't. So these are the hardware features that will allow you to do this. The notion of base and limit registers. Okay. Is this clear? How memory protection is enabled? Any questions here? Okay. So the next thing that we will sort of touch upon briefly is the notion of a memory hierarchy. Okay, so thus far I mentioned registers very briefly. I talked about main memory. We alluded to the disk and the network. But if you actually look at the big picture, what you have on any machine is a hierarchy of memory units. Okay? Starting from the register to the caches to main memory to the disk. Okay? And then the network can be thought of as, if you think about network storage, then the network can be thought of as yet another level in this hierarchy. So what happens is this hierarchy, as you go up, the speed of accessing that memory becomes faster. Okay, but also that memory becomes more expensive. So higher up the picture, the more expensive it becomes to put that memory into the machine, but faster it gets. Okay, so registers are the fastest pieces of memory that you have on any machine, and you have one cycle latency. Okay, meaning that in one cycle, in one clock cycle, you can either read or write to any register. Okay, this is the fastest memory you will have on any machine. Okay. And as you go down, you have the L1 caches and the L2 caches, and then you also have L3 caches on many machines. The caches get bigger, meaning that the amount of data you can store in an L1 cache is a lot more than what you could store in the 16 or whatever, 20 or 50 registers you have on any machine. Okay. But also it's slower. Okay. So L1 cache is 2-cycle latency. L3 cache, 7-cycle latency. Accessing main memory, typically 100 cycle latency. It takes 100 clock cycles for you to access any region of main memory, okay, as opposed to a register, which is one clock cycle. And then if you have a disk, that's 40 million clock cycles, okay, much slower. Okay, anything on the network is even slower, okay, 200 million or more. So this is the picture to keep in mind. This is what's called a memory hierarchy picture. Now, typically when any process is executing, its code and or data could be anywhere in this hierarchy. Okay? Some of its data may be in registers, some may be cached in either the L1, L2, L3 cache. The process will often be loaded in memory. Okay? Pieces of it may be residing on disk, some of it may be residing on a network. Okay? Now, if the application wants to access a piece of data, the lower down it is, the slower it is going to be to access it. And the higher up it is, the faster it's going to be accessed. So the more frequently accessed data should always, or code, should be always higher up in the hierarchy. Otherwise, your application performance is going to suffer. Okay, and the less frequently accessed data or code should be lower down in the hierarchy. Okay, not everything will fit in one of these pieces. Well, that should be clear. You can't register, there may be only 20 registers. You clearly cannot store all of your data in registers. Some of it has to be in main memory or the caches. Okay? Is this clear? So now let's look at what the registers and these caches do. Okay? So you probably know what a register is already. Okay? So any hardware will have what are called general purpose registers and special purpose registers. So general purpose registers are just fast pieces of memory where the compiler or the program can store whatever data it wants to store. Okay, there's no restriction what can be stored in those registers. Okay. Special purpose registers have dedicated functionality associated with them. Okay. So the simplest one is the program counter. Okay. The program counter always stores a memory address. And this is the address of the next instruction that the program wants to execute. Okay, or you can think of it as the current instruction and then it gets incremented to the next one. So this tells you what is the process currently executing. You can only use this register for this purpose. You can't store anything else in there. Okay? Similarly, you have the stack and the frame pointer. Okay? These point to regions in memory where the current stack frame is located. Okay, so in this case, let's say this is main memory and this is the current stack frame. The stack pointer and the frame pointer point to these regions of memory. Okay. So why do you need two? Why do you need a stack pointer and a frame pointer? Why not have only one register? Do people know what a stack and a frame pointer is? So question is, why can we not just get away with one of these two registers? Why do you need two? So clearly one is pointing to the beginning and one is pointing to the end. Yes?
There are several stacks. There's not just one.
Yes.
And the frames are different.
Okay. Right. So basically, as you probably know, the stack grows downwards as each function calls yet another function. Okay, so the stack basically is a set of all, there's not just one stack frame, but there are multiple stack frames. So what the stack and the frame pointer do is that they point to the current stack frame. Okay? The stack pointer points to where the current stack frame begins, and the frame pointer points to where it ends, and the stack keeps growing. Okay? Let's say when you call a new function, this is the current stack, you just pass the arguments. Okay? Then that function makes some space available for the return value. Okay, and then it may have several local variables. So then you allocate space for those variables in the stack, and then the stack grows downwards. So this arrow actually starts pointing to where it ends, and so on. So if this function happens to call the next function, then that stack pointer will now point here, and the frame pointer will keep going down. Okay, so basically, you need to know where the current stack frame begins and where it ends. That's what the stack and frame pointer do. It tells you where it begins and where it ends. Okay, is this clear? So now every time you have to do a context switch, meaning that you basically suspend execution of one process and switch to another process, all of these registers have to be saved somewhere. Okay, because when the next time you resume execution of this process, you then go to that region of memory and load all of those registers back. So you save the state of the current process. Okay, and then you load the context of the next process and start executing. This is what you have to do, and this is what's called a context switch, which we will come back to in more detail when we do processes and threads. Okay. Now coming to caches, I already mentioned that access to main memory is slow, okay, and expensive. So it takes around 100 cycles. So if every piece of data that the program or your process accesses is in main memory, then your process is going to have lots of stalls. Okay, every time you try to access a variable, it will take you 100 cycles. Okay, and then so basically you issue an instruction, it takes one cycle. And then you have to wait for 100 cycles to access that data. So if you do not doing anything for those 99 cycles. Okay. So to prevent this problem, you have faster pieces of memory which are caches and registers. Okay. Now caches are transparent to most programs. Okay. You don't explicitly access data from a cache. It's a transparent thing that sits between your RAM and registers. And these are just fast pieces of memory that mask accesses to frequently access code or data. Okay. So you have multiple levels of caches. Okay. You have the L1 cache, which is on chip. Okay, and it's small. By on chip you mean it's actually on the processor, it's sitting next to the processor. Okay. The L2 cache is typically on chip, but it may be off chip as well. It's a bit bigger. Okay, and then you have L3 cache, which is even bigger and is typically on the system bus. Okay. And this should tell you why it gets slower as you go down. If something is on chip, which means it actually sits, it's a piece of memory that sits right next to where the CPU is, access to that piece of memory should be fast. Okay? But if something is on a bus, is on a system bus, then it's going to be slow because you have to actually send an instruction on the system bus saying, go and look up this piece of memory and send me what's on there. Okay? Yes, question.
English bus alone, isn't that a big cache on the chip?
Yeah. Just make it clear. I'm not sure about that particular processor family, but the trends are to put more and more of these caches closer and closer, meaning that initially, if you look 5 years back, only L1 caches were on processors, L2 were not. Okay, and then as the number of transistors you could pack on a chip started growing, they started putting L2 caches. For some modern processors, you may even put L3 cache, in which case there will be an L4 cache that's off chip. Okay. Right. So I'm not exactly sure because this also keeps changing. It's not a fixed target. Every processor family makes its own decision, even within the Intel family. Okay. Okay. So now let's come to traps. Okay. One more thing I want to mention here. Now, all of this picture assumes that there is only one processor. Okay. But now, as you know, you can get multi-core chips. Okay, one chip has 2, 4, 8 processors. Okay. So again, it's interesting as to whether these caches are shared or dedicated to cores within a processor. Okay. So the old picture is you have the CPU. Okay. And then the L1 cache, let's assume for simplicity, L1 cache is on that chip. Okay. And then this is the system bus, you may have L2 cache here. Okay. More modern architectures may have L2 cache also here. Okay. Now this picture has changed to a different picture where you have chip with core 1. This is the first processor. This is a dual core chip. Second processor. Okay. You also have these caches on these processors. Okay. Then there's an interesting question of whether the caches should be shared. So your L1 cache, which is basically sitting next to it, you may have L2 cache, which is shared. So you have L2 cache also on chip, but this is shared, which means that this processor can overwrite entries in here that belong to this processor. Okay, so you can have cache pollution and so on. And L3 cache may be external. Okay. There are important implications of how you design operating systems to make sure that cache performance is not impacted. Okay. We will come back to this problem when we talk about multiple processors, which includes multiple cores. Okay? But just keep this in mind that when you have multiple cores, you may have shared caches. And shared caches always means that one processor can then cause another processor's data or code to get evicted from the cache, impacting the performance of the process that's executing on that processor. Yes.
What cores design, where would you classify
L2
cache? Like, would that be next to the chip or on the chip?
No, typically, it will be on the chip, but as I said, that L1 is dedicated. Okay, this is so this core will not have access to this cache, and this core is not going to have access to this cache. This will probably be also on chip, but typically it's shared, not partitioned. You could have also thought of a partitioned architecture, right? If you are designing hardware designer, you could actually have this picture. Yeah, so you have one L1 cache and one L2 cache. Here you have one L1 and L2. But this is not the picture that you have in the current generation of multi-core. You have a shared L2 cache. That's all I was pointing out. Okay, it's on chip but shared. Okay. So coming back to traps. What are traps and how do they work? Yeah, so think of a trap as a special condition that is detected by the architecture. Okay, this could be an error. Typically it's an error condition, but it doesn't have to be. Okay, there are valid conditions why you may have traps, but think of an error condition. You did a divide by zero. Okay, that's an error. Okay, you overflowed an integer. That's an error. You try to access an illegal address in memory. Also an error. You try to execute a privileged instruction in user mode. Okay, all of these are error conditions. So how should the hardware and the operating systems deal with error condition? That's what traps allow you to do. Okay? So what happens when you have a trap? And so some of these special conditions. And there are valid conditions why you may also have a trap, like a page fault, but we'll come back to that in just a moment. So what happens, okay, when you have a trap? So whenever any process does something that causes a trap, the hardware will save the state of that process. Okay, you will basically save the program counter, the stack and so on, and it then transfers control to the operating system. Okay? And then you call what is called a trap handler. Okay? This is the function that is written to handle that error condition. Okay, if you have done exception handling in Java, okay, whenever your program throws an exception, you go into an exception handler. Okay? That handles the exception, whatever that is. Similar concept. In an operating system, you have a trap, and as a trap handler, okay, think of a trap as an exception. So whenever you have an exception, you save the program state, and then you jump to a trap handler, which is going to handle that error. Okay, so then there's a question of how do you actually do this. Okay, so that's basically shown on this picture. So how to figure out what is the right trap handler, you have what's called a trap vector. Okay, trap vector stores the address of each trap handler that you have written. Okay? So think of the trap ID as the type exception ID. So you have trap 0, which is illegal address. That's the exception that you will have when you have illegal address. You will actually do what you go. So you go and look in this vector. That's a memory address. And that is the memory address where the functions is resides to handle that error. Okay? So whenever you have a trap, you look at the trap ID, you index into this vector. Okay? Then you jump to this memory address, and that is where you have the function of the exception handler that is going to handle that exception for you or that trap for you. Okay? And then once you handle that exception, you will go back to the program. Okay? In most cases, the exceptions cause the program to crash, okay? But not always. Okay? Is this clear what this picture is? So this shows you what hardware support you have to provide. You need to have this notion of a trap vector. So whenever you have a trap, you will have to then look at this trap vector and says, where do I need to go in order to handle this error? And this tells you the memory address that you have to jump to in order to handle that trap. And that's where you have this exceptional handling routine or trap handling routine. Okay? Then once you have handled the trap, you will resume execution of the process. Okay? Now this should tell you exactly, now if I go back several slides. I showed you this trap. Okay? This is exactly what's happening when you have a system call. Okay? You have a trap, which is like an interrupt. Then you look up the trap vector and say, this is a system call. Okay? This is not an illegal, this is not an error, but this is a special type of a trap. So then you jump to the part of the operating system that allows you to handle that system call. Okay? That is done by indexing the trap vector. Okay? Then you execute the system call, and then you come back and resume execution of the process. Okay. So this is how this arrow and the other arrow work, are basically what are shown in these slides. Okay, on the slides. Is this clear? what a trap is. Any questions here? Yes, no. It's not clear, ask a question. I see completely blank faces here. Okay. So if you think about it, if you if something is not clear, you can always come back and ask. But it's always good to ask while I'm explaining, that way you get your doubts clarified. So the next thing we are going to talk about is I/O control. Okay. So we talked about, I showed you these I/O devices, right, in the initial slides. So question is, how do you actually do input and output to these I/O devices? Okay. So if you look at it, each I/O device has what is called an I/O controller. Okay. A controller is a special piece of hardware that has a small processor in it. Okay. It's called an embedded microcontroller. So this is no different from your CPU, except that it's a very small one. Okay. It basically executes some instructions that allow you to actually do input and output to that device. Okay. So the way you actually do I/O is, the CPU issues commands to the I/O controller. Okay, it says go execute this command, go read or write the following piece of data. Okay, and then the I/O controller takes over and starts executing those commands. Okay, while it is executing the commands, the CPU is now going to continue execution. Okay, so CPU just issues a command saying, let's say you print this file. Okay, it's going to issue this to the printer. Okay. And then the printer driver and the controller are going to start the task of actually printing the thing. Okay. While it is doing this, the processor, the CPU, is going to continue execution. Once the I/O device is done with that I/O request, it is going to raise an interrupt. Okay. This will cause the CPU to suspend doing whatever it was doing, and then it will go back and examine what happened to that I/O request. Okay, and then it will, if it's successful, then it will say it was successful, or if not, then it will retrieve the error code and then it will hand that back to the application. Okay, this is how any I/O controller works. Okay, now I'll talk about, there are multiple ways you can do I/O. Okay, one is called synchronous. So what I just described is what is called asynchronous I/O, that's shown in this picture. Okay, so this is the requesting process. Let's say you want to print. Okay, so this is the printer driver. Okay, there is an interrupt handler and this is the hardware, this is the printer itself. Okay, so the issuing process is going to say print this file. Okay, will hand it to the printer driver. The printer driver will start issuing some commands to the printer, saying start printing. Okay, it may start sending data to the printer. So while it is doing this, your CPU is going to continue doing something else. Okay, it will start executing other processes that are running and so on. Okay, it doesn't actively participate in the I/O process or the printing process in this case, which is why we have these dotted lines here, okay, not solid lines. Okay. So now after some point in time, let's say the print job is done. Okay. At this point, okay, the print driver is going to raise an interrupt to the CPU. Okay. The CPU will now stop doing what it was doing and it will come back to the interrupt handler and start processing this interrupt. Okay. This basically, the interrupt is just saying that the I/O request has finished. Okay. And so in this case, the CPU can just look at the status of the print job, whether it was successful or it failed. Okay. But if this is some other type of I/O device, okay, some data may have arrived on the network. So if this is a network card, okay, if this is an Ethernet card or your wireless card, whenever some data arrives on your network card, you raise an interrupt. Okay, saying I received some packets from the network. Okay. So the CPU then suspends execution of the current process. Okay, and it executes, then it starts processing the interrupt. It will go to the network card and receive the data from the network card. And then it will do something with the data. So this data came, let's say, to your web browser, it will then hand this over to the web browser, saying, here is what you requested. Okay? And then it continues execution. Okay? This is called asynchronous mode, okay? Also called the non-blocking mode of operation. What is shown in this picture is what is called a synchronous or blocking mode. Okay. This is yet another mode of doing I/O. Typically, when you have I/O controllers, you will have this mode. Okay. But there are instances where you may do this as well. Okay. So in this case, it's also I/O, but there's one important difference. Okay. Again, let's say the requesting process has issued an I/O request. Okay. it comes to the device driver, the device driver starts processing the I/O request. But in this case, the requesting process is going to block or it's going to wait. Okay? In the previous case, basically the CPU continued execution. In this case, the requesting process blocks until the I/O command finishes and you get back the status response. Okay? The rest of the picture is the same, except that here you have the process is waiting, there it's not waiting. Okay? So this is difference between what's called blocking I/O and non-blocking I/O. Okay? Typically when you have user level applications, you may have only encountered this mode of operation. Okay, so you suppose you have a Java program, you open a file and you decide to read from the file. Okay? This is a blocking command, you issue read and you wait, your process is waiting until the read command returns. Okay, with some data or possibly an error message. That's the blocking mode. Okay. But you also, most languages will also support the non-blocking mode. In this case, you will actually issue the read command and your process will immediately, that method will immediately return and you will continue execution. At some later point in time, you will actually receive an interrupt saying that read that you issued sometime back has finished. Okay. At that point, you have to go and handle that interrupt and actually get the data that the read return. Okay. That's that mode of operation. Okay. So you're probably mostly familiar with this, but in the operating system, you typically deal with this. And even at user level, you can actually do this if you know what you want.
As far as the programming environment, when you have asynchronous releases and that sort of stuff, you have to have sort of an event-based environment so that when the interrupt comes down, you can apply an event.
Yes. So question is, if you have asynchronous I/O where you have non-blocking read, do you have this notion of event-based environments? Okay. So basically all of these interrupts are modeled as events. Whenever you have asynchronous I/O or any programming environment that supports asynchronous I/O, this is also called event-based programming.
Okay.
So basically everything is asynchronous and you deal with events. You issue commands and some event occurs later, then you go and handle that event. That's the way things work, okay, which is very different from the way you're normally used to program. Okay, so now what we will do is we'll actually not worry about this for now, okay? Because in the operating system you typically do this. We'll look at two modes of doing asynchronous I/O. Okay, one is called memory mapped, and then the other one is interrupt based. Okay, so in what happens in memory mapped I/O is that you use the abstraction of reading and writing to memory as a way to do input and output to a hardware device. Okay? The easiest way to understand this is to think of a graphics card, okay, the graphics adapter in your machine. Okay, the way you typically, the OS typically works is as follows. Okay, let's say this is RAM. Okay. So your graphics card, this is your fancy monitor. Okay, so let's assume that you have a process, okay, that wants to display an image on the monitor or on your screen. Okay, how would it go about doing this? Okay, if you look at the previous picture, right, the picture I mentioned here. So if you want to do this, this is an I/O device. So what you typically do is you would actually give it, you would issue an I/O command to the graphics card saying here is a piece of data, go and display it onto the screen. Okay? And then you would actually give the data over to the graphics card and the graphics card would do something and it would basically return with an interrupt at a later time. Okay? A better way to do this or a simpler way to do this is what's called memory mapped I/O. So what happens in memory mapped I/O is that the buffer or the so here is the memory or the buffer that's present on the graphics card. Okay, any I/O device will have some buffer that allows it to do input and output. What the operating system does is it maps this buffer to a region of memory, a special region of memory. Okay, so now it looks like your RAM has become bigger. Okay, so the blue region is actually not physical RAM, but it's logical RAM. And whenever you try to read and write to this region to automatically read and write to the memory on the graphics card directly. Okay. So what does it doing is it's giving you direct I/O access to the I/O controller. Okay. The buffer on the I/O controller just starts looking like a RAM on your machine. So to read and write to the device, you just read and write to this special region of RAM. Okay. So simply by reading or writing a special region of memory, you are doing input and output to a device. Okay. So you are using the abstraction of reading and writing to RAM in order to do I/O. Instead of issuing I/O commands and having the controller do something, we just read and write to memory. So going back to our example of displaying, let's say, an image onto the screen, what you would basically do is you will so let's suppose that's the image. Okay. So what you would do is you just copy this image over into this region of memory, into the right location in that memory. And magically whatever you return to that memory starts getting displayed onto the screen. So you don't have to explicitly issue any command to the graphics adapter. You just write to that region and then the graphics adapter picks whatever is in this region and starts displaying it onto your screen. Okay, and that's all you have to do. Okay. Is this clear what memory mapped I/O is? So what you have done is you have mapped a region of the I/O controller, the buffer, into a region of RAM, and you are using the abstraction of reading and writing to RAM to do I/O. Okay. The other model is what I had shown in the previous slide, which is the more standard interrupt based asynchronous I/O. You can't use direct mapped I/O memory mapped I/O for every possible device. Okay, this only works for certain special device where it makes sense. Okay, in most cases, you are actually going to use interrupt based asynchronous I/O. Okay. So things like keyboard and mouse, you will never do this. Okay, you will basically do this. So whenever you, let's say, click on a mouse, it's going to trigger an interrupt. Okay? That will cause the hardware to save the state of the current process. You jump into the interrupt service routine. Okay? In this case, the interrupt is a mouse click, let's say. So then you basically go into the mouse driver and see what was the corresponding event that triggered this. And then you capture that event and then you handle it in the graphics card. Okay. So basically these are all the steps. You save the state of the hardware, then you disable interrupts. I'll talk about this in just a second. You save the state of the process. You invoke the interrupt handler. Okay. And here you use an interrupt vector which is similar to a trap vector. Okay. And then you handle the interrupt, then you restore the software state, you enable the interrupt, and you continue execution of the process. Okay. So there are two additional steps that you need to understand here. Disabling and enabling interrupts. Okay, it's steps 2 and 9, and what this interrupt vector is. Okay. So the interrupt vector is very similar to the trap vector. Okay, so this is what it shows. So for every possible event or an interrupt that could occur, there's an interrupt service routine. This is the exception handler. Okay. The interrupt vector stores the address of that exception handler. Whenever that exception occurs, you look up this table, you see where is the interrupt handler stored in memory. You jump to that region and that function executes. Okay, as simple as that. No different from the trap vector. Okay? So here is the keyboard interrupt, here is your mouse, here is the timer, the disk could raise an interrupt. So there will be a long list of interrupts that could occur on your machine. Okay? So that is what this step is. Now what is this disabling and enabling interrupt? So why are we disabling and enabling interrupts here? Any thoughts? Yes.
First
on
instructions to ensure the integrity of the manipulation.
Right. So whenever you are handling an interrupt, okay, you typically don't want another interrupt to occur and interrupt the execution of this interrupt. Okay. So what you do is before you actually start servicing the interrupt, you will disable any additional interrupts. That means if there is a new interrupt that occurs, it will either be queued or it may be lost depending on what the hardware does. And then you execute this interrupt service routine and then you enable interrupt. This allows you atomicity, as was pointed out. Okay, this means that whenever you service this interrupt, you are never going to jump off and do something else. It's guaranteed that you will actually finish execution of this interrupt before you handle the next one. Okay, so you are going to mask all interrupts at the beginning of the interrupt service routine for atomicity. Otherwise, the code gets pretty complicated because you are in the middle of receiving a packet and something else happens and you go somewhere and then data gets lost or corrupted or you have other problem. Okay, so whenever you handle interrupts, you want to make sure that no other interrupt will occur when you are handling this one. So always you basically surround this interrupt service routine by disabling and then re-enabling it when you are done. Okay, this is very important for integrity. Okay, is this clear? How to do this, we will talk about in a different class. How to enable and disable interrupts. Okay, so I have the two slides, so I'm going to continue in just in this step. Okay, so the next one is synchronization. Okay, so what is synchronization? So this is going to be entire set of classes. Okay, we have like two or three lectures that are coming up where we will deal with this topic in more detail. But as far as this class is concerned, what we are interested in is what is it that the hardware supports so that the operating system can implement this notion of synchronization. Okay, so the ability, so what the operating system wants is the ability to synchronize between cooperating or concurrent processes. Okay, so the architecture must provide a guarantee where short sequences of instructions execute atomically so that they cannot be interrupted. Okay, so what are these features that allow you to execute things atomically? So one we already saw in the previous slide. So the ability to enable and disable interrupts allow you to execute a piece of code atomically so that nothing else can interrupt that execution of piece of code. Okay. Another hardware feature that is available on many architectures is a special instructions called a test and set. Okay. This tests a condition and sets a bit if the condition is true in one atomic instruction. Okay. So we'll come back to the test and set instructions when we do locks and semaphore. But this is another hardware feature, and I'm assuming that you at least run into the test and set instruction before, even if you may not have heard of interrupts. Okay? So this is something to keep in mind, what a test and set instruction is. Okay? The last concept is that of virtual memory. Okay? So what virtual memory is the ability to run programs without loading the whole program in memory. Okay? So suppose that you want to execute Microsoft Word or Internet Explorer. Let's assume that this program is 50 megabytes in size or 100 megabytes in size. Okay? So when you double click on this program, okay, the program starts loading in memory. If you have to wait until this entire 100 megabytes loads in memory, you are going to be waiting a while. Okay? Instead, what the operating system can do is it can load the first chunks of this program and start executing this program even before the entire program is loaded. It doesn't have to load the whole thing in memory. Parts of it can still sit on disk. It can bring them on demand into memory and execute them. Okay? The ability to do this is called virtual memory. Okay? Virtual memory is basically what this does is it allows you to run programs even when the whole program is not loaded. Only when pieces of it are resident in memory, the rest of them may be resident on disk. So even if you only have small chunks of a program loaded, you can still run the program. And then when you need the missing chunks, you just bring them dynamically, fetch them from disk as needed, and that's what triggers a page fault. Okay, we'll come back to all of this in a moment. But this is something to know. Okay, your process can be bigger than size of RAM. It doesn't have to be resident in RAM for it to run. And the operating system actually provides this nice functionality for you. So this gives you both speed and flexibility. Okay, so that's a very quick overview through lots of hardware features. Okay, this is something you should be somewhat familiar with in order to understand what's actually coming down the road. We haven't even started operating systems yet. We're just doing a review of architecture. But you need to know all of these concepts. Okay, so make sure you do a quick review of this because we'll start talking about these in more detail next time. Okay. So again, a reminder for those of you who came late that there is a discussion section tomorrow. Okay, make sure you attend it because we'll have things to supplement stuff and exercises so you can be familiar with the lab assignment. Okay.